And welcome to this beautiful setting here at the Kaiser Family Foundation's Barbara Jordan Center, where we have this timely and auspicious opportunity to hear from Secretary Michael Levitt and hear his reflections on the centrality of health diplomacy to U.S. foreign policy interests and his recommendations and thoughts to the next administration and Congress on how our health diplomacy can be further strengthened in the future. I'm Steve Morrison, and I head the CSIS Global Health Policy Center, which is a newly established initiative dedicated to advancing a long-term strategic approach by the United States in advancing global health. This is heir to the CSIS Smart Power Commission, which reaffirmed the very high value of expanded investments in global health in promoting U.S. good standing and good deeds around the world, and it is heir also to the seven-year-old CSIS Task Force on HIV/AIDS, which brought HIV/AIDS more deeply into the foreign policy circles and used CSIS special convening powers. One important stream of our work at the center is the high-level speaker series, in which we seek to promote an active dialogue with diverse sources on the importance of global health, its emerging challenges, and pragmatic ways forward. Today is a very important event in that speaker series. I'll return to that in a moment. We, just as a mention of upcoming events, Ward Cassells, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, will speak at CSIS on January 7th at 1 p.m. And Dr. Bill Steiger, who's here with us today from HHS and Special Advisor to the Secretary of International Affairs, will speak at 10 a.m. on January 12th at CSIS. Pamela Barnes will be speaking on January 13th at 11 a.m., head of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And former Secretary Tommy Thompson, former HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson, will be speaking January 26th at 2:30 p.m. He has become very active on the neglected tropical disease front. We remain very reliant upon and grateful to our friends, and particularly the Kaiser Family Foundation, who've hosted us today and who will be webcasting this speech and the dialogue that follows by Secretary Levitt. They are one of our most valued partners and involved in our work across the board. Their dedication to objectivity and evidence-based policy approaches on health, their technological ingenuity, their compassion, and attention to innovative media work, they're all quite exceptional. And we're especially grateful to Drew Altman, Diane Rowland, Jennifer Cates, Alicia Carbow, for all of their support and all the things that they have done for us. A few remarks on the context we find ourselves today in which we've asked Secretary Levitt to join us. We're heading into an historic period of pursuing, during the next administration, reform of our national health care system. That will be a huge enterprise and complicated and difficult on multiple fronts, and it will beg the issue, the vital issue, of what will happen and how what happens within our system relates to what we do outside our borders. We'll hear some about that today. One answer to that question, I believe, is that global health should be understood very broadly. It should be understood certainly as encompassing what we do at home and what we do outside our home. It is not over there. It is with us. And what we do on global health should directly touch our lives, our health, our well-being. And it should encompass, as I think we'll hear today, multiple dimensions. It should encompass the dimension of moral and humanitarian compassion and the altruistic generosity of Americans. It should touch the protection of U.S. national interests, the promotion of markets, human rights, and other vital interests. And it requires that we reveal, perhaps better than we have up to now, to American citizens why and how the investments we make over there in diplomacy, prestige, and resources are in America's long-term vital interests. We're also heading into a severe domestic and global economic downturn that will test all of us in the next year and perhaps beyond on preserving the many gains that we've achieved in the last few years, achieving higher efficiencies, reaffirming our principles and our priorities, and demonstrating that we're agile and pragmatic in navigating this crisis and advancing a domestic and international health agenda. We know, based on prior eras of recession, that there will be cuts in development assistance and in countries' own investments in health. We need sound strategies with dealing with the threat that is out there of regression, of losing the achievements or eroding the achievements of the past decade. It's important that we begin publicly and thoughtfully addressing these issues and devising creative strategies. From our prior speakers, Mark Dybul, who's here with us today, Peter Piot, we've heard many useful thoughts, and I'm hoping we will hear more. From Secretary Leavitt, I'm sure we will. We're at the end of the Bush era, where the world was tested in many new ways on global health. HIV/AIDS, SARS, avian influenza, food safety, and we've created a much denser and more complex international diplomacy around these issues. We've carried U.S. programs and investments to an unprecedented scale and level of ambition, and we now face the question of how we will preserve and carry forward that legacy, refining it and preserving the bipartisan centrist core that has made that possible. It's a period when the Secretary of Health and Human Services discovered a higher and higher proportion of his time and energies dedicated to international affairs. Secretary Leavitt, thank you so much for being with us today. The Secretary has led the Department since January of 2005, and in that period has placed a special focus on pandemic preparedness, on opening dialogue on health with leaders in Central America and Asia and elsewhere, on pressing for a more active global dialogue on diabetes, HIV/AIDS, health system strengthening, including critical workforce needs. He is someone who has been moved by the power of personal contact with individuals around the globe who struggle to maintain their health and that of their families and loved ones. He is someone who has seen up close the dramatic power that our soft power assets bring us when we focus on health. So please join me in welcoming Secretary Leavitt here today to Kaiser Family Foundation.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you today. I was, in the final moments of my preparation, placed in a room overlooking the Church of the Epiphany. It occurred to me as I did so that perhaps it was an epiphany that my three-year-old grandson recently had. His mother reported to me that they were struggling to determine what he would wear for Halloween. He thought he should be a dinosaur. His mother, I think on the basis of the fact that she had a pumpkin costume, thought it should be a pumpkin. After some thought, and perhaps an epiphany, he broke free from her, ran to his room, came back, having just stepped out of the bathtub, put his cowboy hat on and said, "I want to be a naked cowboy." Not sure that falls into the epiphany category. Some months ago, I was in an alley in New Delhi. I had a little boy, just a little younger than my grandson, across my lap, and I had his head tipped back. And I was just about to drop two drops of polio vaccine into his mouth. His mother, I would say in her late 20s, had knelt down in front of me and was holding the little boy's head. Our eyes met. Now, the circumstances of our lives could not have been more different. I was a member of the cabinet of the President of the United States. I live in a very comfortable townhouse across the Potomac River from the nation's capital. She lives in a home in which I stood in front of with a blanket for a door, and dirt on the floor. But there was an engagement between us that happens between two people who have something in common, and it was a desire for this little boy's health to be protected. Our lives only intersected for a few moments, but I left a little different, and I think she did too. Her little boy was protected from polio. I think she had a higher regard for the United States, and I had a higher regard for her. I had a similar sort of wordless communication in a home in Zanzibar. We had gone not for the purpose of polio, but we were there because we were spraying for mosquitoes to try and prevent malaria. This time I was talking to the man of the house. We didn't speak the same language, but we had the same moment where we were talking about the health of his family with our eyes. I've had that experience with HIV victims in different villages throughout Africa. They say the words USA with their lips, but with their eyes they say, thank you. It's very clear to them and to me that the treatments they're receiving as a result of the generosity of the United States has preserved their life. I've seen the impressive effect that a white hospital ship makes when it pulls up to a port anywhere in the world. I've seen people line up hours and hours in advance in hope that they'll leave with a new pair of glasses or without the persistent toothache that has been vexing them. Some come for surgeries that repair a debilitating hernia or cataracts on their eyes. Tens of thousands of people are served when those ships pull into every port, but there are millions that know we're there. Our nation supports a lot of different things. We develop water. We do economic development, try to help people with jobs. We do education all over the world. We provide joint research. We train soldiers. We provide weapons. We give food. We even give money. But there is nothing more powerful that we do than to minister to the health of people who are in need. Why? Because the language of health is really heard in the heart. The richest and poor of us are bound together by an uncertainty of our mortality and the desperation of pain. It's a universal language. You give a mother with HIV AIDS hope that she can raise her children and she'll have a gratitude that will never wane. Heal a father's child and he'll never forget. You give a teenager with disfigured legs the mobility and the dignity of mobility and he will praise your name forever. As Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki said to me one day, health is a good messenger of peace. In geopolitics, there is this sort of constant struggle for the affinity of the hearts of people. In that battle, may I suggest that deeds speak louder than words. And on the Richter scale of deeds, health is the one that makes the needle jiggle the fastest inside the human heart. Now, there's a lot of talk these days about the use of hard power and soft power. Hard power, of course, being the military or the economic prowess of a nation. Soft power nudges, of course, in more subtle ways, relying on the accumulation of friendship or trust. My colleague, Secretary Bob Gates, recently told an audience this. He said, in short, based on my experience serving seven presidents as the former director of the CIA and now as the Secretary of Defense, I am here to make the case for strengthening our capacity to use soft power and for better integrating it into hard power. Later today, if someone asks you what Mike Leavitt talked about, I hope you'll be able to remember three things. The first is that the Secretary of Health agrees with the Secretary of Defense that hard power and soft power work best when they're integrated. The second is that health diplomacy is the highest octane fuel that our soft power machine has. And third, I want to make a series of quite specific recommendations, if I could, to President-elect Obama and his administration on how I believe we could develop our health diplomacy potential. I want to go a little further now in making the case for health diplomacy. I'm not sure there's a better testimony of the degree to which it's effective than to just look at the way our enemies use it. In Lebanon, where the legitimate government has tried and failed to provide adequate health care, Hezbollah, which is a political party essentially devoted to terrorism, offers on-the-ground medical services to in poor Shia areas. They have clinics and hospitals throughout the country. It's in large part to help them establish a political force. They know that war alone is insufficient to build trust. Early in the Iraq War, it became clear that Al-Qaeda was going to target the healthcare sector as a means of being able to discredit the new government. I was in Iraq last month. I met with a group of doctors from different parts of the country. Their stories of brutality toward everyone who was involved in health were chilling, and you just have to admit it worked. Of an estimated 34,000 doctors in the mid-90s, at least 20,000 of them have left the country. Since 2003 alone, 8,000 have quit practicing medicine, mostly because of fear. More than 2,200 of them have been killed. Over 250 of them have been kidnapped. They live in constant fear of them, of it. It has crippled their health institutions. It's led to corruption, mismanagement, and terrible conditions within their hospital system. The availability and the quality of health care has diminished, and people's confidence in their government has suffered. Now, part of the successful surge strategy that we hear talked of often has been greater support of Iraq's health sector. And things are improving. The government now has a new health minister. While I was there, I had a chance to meet with a second group of Iraqi doctors who will be coming to the U.S. In fact, I've met with them since they got here. A month from now, they stayed here for a month. And I can tell you when they left with cell phone numbers, email numbers with medical colleagues in the United States, and those relationships will last a long time. Their relationships, not just medical relationships, they left with a different impression of the United States. This kind of thing builds trust, not just between the United States and the people of Iraq, but more importantly, between the Iraqi people and the new Iraqi government. It's the same in Afghanistan. The Taliban knows the importance of health to its people. Two just brief stories. When health workers heard that President Karzai was going to endorse an anti-polio campaign like the one I talked about in New Delhi, they immediately asked him not to. They said, essentially, if the Taliban knows that the government's interested in it, they'll attack us. A second story. I have a friend at the Ministry of Health in Afghanistan. He told me the story of negotiating with the Taliban for the return of a kidnapped health worker. He said that to persuade this Taliban leader, who had been an Islamic cleric, my friend appealed to his cultural sensitivities by saying, this man comes from a good family. He's not part of our war. He just wants to help people. He said the Taliban leader replied, he brings credit to the government, and that's why we took him. And he then went on, incidentally, to threaten my friend with the same fate. There it is. Health is a legitimizer of governments and of ideologies. Health also legitimizes revolutionary socialists. Fidel Castro has very little hard power, if you will, on that small island of Cuba, but he has become a master at the use of health diplomacy to create soft power. The commonly accepted estimates have the number of Cuban-trained doctors that have been placed all over the world at about 40,000. It's Castro built a series of medical schools from which he graduates thousands of doctors and nurses every year. Graduates are then deployed into underserved nations all over the world. The doctors become trusted members of the community, and they become quite influential political organizers, if you will, among the poor and the disadvantaged. They have stature in their community. They become politically active, and they feed the discontented. And then they're given a small salary, and Castro even makes some money on the deal. It's actually a very clever strategy. In terms of land and population, the island of Cuba is about the size of the state of Pennsylvania. It has an economy that's smaller than West Virginia. But in international health matters, Cuba clearly punches greater than its weight in health diplomacy. Doctors that are schooled in Cuba are not particularly well trained. In many cases, medical associations around the world complain that they can't pass the qualifying exams in the countries where they're practicing. However, if you're a poor person in an underserved neighborhood in Central America or in Africa, they're a big improvement over nothing. I've met Cuban doctors in El Salvador. I've met them in Guatemala and Honduras and Nicaragua and Haiti and Mozambique and Tanzania. When I was in Timbuktu not long ago, I met this team of U.S. Special Forces personnel who told me they had just returned from the northern part of Mali, where they had been providing health care services to the people there. They told me that there are teams of Cuban doctors who are there permanently. Recently, there was a Central American health minister that told me we depend on Cuba for the training of our doctors. We don't have any alternative right now, he said. Can I suggest to you that it's not a good thing for the United States to have Central American governments dependent upon Cuba? Hugo Chavez is adopting the same model. He currently began building a large medical school to be able to train doctors to export all over the world. The fact is, in many regions of the world, democracies are in a test drive status, if you will. Healthcare is a litmus test for these governments on whether they are legitimate and whether they're effective. Using healthcare to discredit democracy and the ideologies of liberty is a tactic that's right out of the insurrectionist handbook. In Central America, I believe we're at some risk of seeing 30 years of progress toward democracy erode. In country after country in Latin America, leftist governments are being elected. Healthcare is being used by their left-leaning candidates to stir up discontentment among the people. First time I met Hugo Chavez, he said to me, "So what is the infant mortality rate in the United States, or in Washington, D.C.?" he said. In Cuba, he said, it's about 6 out of 1,000. Now, I have no idea whether what he said about Cuba is accurate, neither does he. But the fact that he used Washington, D.C., where it's a little higher than it is around the rest of the United States, demonstrated to me that he was using this simply as a means of comparing their capacity as a socialist government with ours as a democracy. And you know he's doing the same thing among those to whom he appeals for power. Chavez in Venezuela, Morales in Bolivia, those are only the beginning. In the last 3 years, we've seen Daniel Ortega reelected as the president of Nicaragua. Mexico came within a couple of 100,000 votes of having the leftist mayor of Mexico City elected as their president. We've seen the president of Honduras team up with Cuba and Bolivia and Venezuela in various economic ways. Next year, we have El Salvador and Panama, two of our very solid relationships in Central America, who will have elections. And there are candidates who have serious leftist ideologies that are very competitive in these elections. The enemies of democracy use health as a tool to win the hearts of people. Health speaks to the heart. Let me acknowledge for just a moment that there are some who feel that humanitarian assistance, being measured in self-interested foreign policy goals, is a kind of crass abandonment of sincerity. They think that global health should be about benevolence. They feel uncomfortable measuring the benefit of health diplomacy. But we can be benevolent and benefit. In fact, I would argue that if we benefit from our aid, our capacity to support it in the competitive nature of our budgets will clearly be enhanced. Global health starts with a very humbling equation, and that is that there are vastly more needs than the world can ever expect to meet, at least a nation like ours. So we have to decide what our capacity is, and then we need to strategically allocate our benevolence. The benefits, however, go beyond just diplomatic points. Health diplomacy also protects health and the safety of Americans here at home in the United States. The global economy and global health are now traveling companions. The nature and volume of travel, the nature of trade, the human interactions that we have on a regular basis demonstrate that. If an infectious disease exists anywhere in the world, there's danger everywhere. In the last century, we've had 3 pandemic influenzas that have struck. The pandemic of 1918 took more than 50 million lives worldwide, and it included more than 600,000 in the United States. There have been at least 10 pandemics in the last 300 years, and there's no reason to believe that in the next century we'll be any different than the previous 3. If a highly infectious influenza virus begins to spread among human beings anywhere in the world, it'll take less than 3 weeks for it to reach the borders of the United States. It's in our interest to help other nations develop disease monitoring systems and other tools that are necessary to protect their citizens and ours. Health diplomacy in that context is as much self-interest as it is altruism. Our benevolence clearly produces benefits. When I was the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, I came to understand the adverse effects that it can have on our nation's health when pollution happens in others. The black puff of smoke that you see coming from a factory or a tailpipe in China or in Mexico may well be breathed in California or in Maine. Likewise, more and more of our medicines are being produced in places like China and India. This last month, we opened offices of the Food and Drug Administration in China. Next month, we'll do it in India and in Latin America, not just to inspect goods, but to work very closely with their governments to improve the systems of health there. This is not just out of a sense of benevolence, but out of a sense of benefit as well. Most of the fruits and vegetables that we consume in the United States during the winter months are grown in Central America. The quality and safety of those crops are reliant on quality water. Here's an interesting example. The people of Nicaragua, understandably unhappy with the quality of the water they drink. I volunteered to bring a group of experts from our government to work with their government and civil society in Nicaragua to clean up the Lake Managua, which is their primary source of water. Now, President Ortega and I spent several hours. We got in his Jeep to see some things around Lake Managua. He drove. I was his passenger. It was a kind of unique diplomatic moment. I was there helping him solve a problem that was critical to his people and to his people's prosperity, and at the same time, I was protecting the health of the United States. I've learned as Secretary of Health that I have to spend a lot more time outside the United States these days than I used to take care of the health of the people inside the United States. I had a similar experience in Honduras. There's another important lesson here. Working together on mutually important water problems in Nicaragua and in Honduras have created some personal relationships of trust with their heads of state and other leaders within those communities. Both Nicaragua and Honduras are fragile democracies. They have a lot of history and a lot of contemporary forces that pull them to the left. I spent a day vaccinating chickens against avian influenza in Vietnam. In doing so, I was helping protect poor farmers' livelihoods. At the same time, I was protecting American citizens against avian influenza. The fact is, there's an important lesson here. Not only from the fact that it helps both of us, I picked up one other lesson, and that is veterinary medicine is a very powerful diplomatic tool. Many times when we would hold clinics and invite people to come get their animals cared for, they would come in large numbers. Ask them to come with their children in smaller numbers. But if you, they'll bring their children with their animals and you can vaccinate them then. You offer people a chance to help with their cows or their camels and you'll draw a big crowd. But the point here is that water safety, health security, veterinary care, environmental health, all of these are part of health diplomacy. Not only helping to help those people in that country, but also the citizens of the United States. Now, there's another way in which health diplomacy helps the United States of America. I think it was Mary Poppins who sang, "A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down." I was recently asked by Sherry Renman, who serves as Pakistan's Minister of Health and Minister of Communication. I asked her the question, do you think that the people of Pakistan have any idea the amount of money and assistance that the United States provides to Pakistan? Her reply was unequivocal. She said, no. She said, in fact, I didn't know until recently. Then she went on to very candidly tell me something everyone here is aware of, and that she said, look, Americans aren't very well thought of by the general population of Pakistan. We're important allies in the war on terror. The United States spends billions of dollars in helping Pakistan to support our mutual interests. Despite that, most polls show that less than 10% of the people of Pakistan have a favorable impression of the United States. Now, there are a lot of complex circumstances that contribute to our nation's lack of acceptance in Pakistan, including the unpopularity of former President Musharraf, who was supported by the United States. But she said, the health minister said, there's a notable exception here. In the northern part of Pakistan, in the zone where the earthquake hit in 2005, the reputation of the United States is very good. The minister went on to tell me that the essence that people remember the image of Chinook helicopters coming to rescue them in their hour of need. Helicopters are gone, she said, but the American people stayed. And with their NGOs and the support of the government, they helped us rebuild their communities. In those areas, well over 50% of the people, even 2 years later, have a very favorable impression of the United States, a far cry from the 10% everywhere else. Now, I went to that region. I was interested to hear it or see it. I went to small villages where they were still digging out from underneath the rubble 2 years later. I saw small health clinics that they were helping to build. I met with health workers that they were training. And the minister is correct. We are thought of well there. I was welcomed, as is our country, in a powerful way. Now, this isn't just about getting our approval ratings up. This is about benefiting from our benevolence. A few weeks later, I read in the paper about American and NATO troops entering Pakistan territory seeking to root out a high-profile al-Qaeda leader who had been hiding in their mountains. It was a necessary use of hard power, one that would ultimately and obviously create a sense of controversy among our critics in Pakistan. And I'm guessing the reaction in the earthquake area wasn't quite as quick or quite as severe. This is what Bob Gates has been talking about. It's the integration of our hard power and our soft power, benevolence and benefit. And the United States has dramatically increased its use of health diplomacy, recently authorized 5-year budgets, for example, represent a 7 times greater effort than before the Bush administration. Health has become a significant tool in our foreign policy apparatus, and it's not just at the State Department, it's across the board. USAID obviously carries a great deal of this responsibility at the State Department, but the Department of Defense, the Department of Agriculture, Health and Human Services, the Environmental Protection Agency, all of them are doing things in the broader category of health diplomacy that make a huge difference. And what government does is really only a very small part of the American picture. thousands of U.S. non-governmental organizations, corporations, universities, private citizens, and are providing assistance all over the world. The combined government and non-government assistance makes the United States the most generous humanitarian force perhaps in human history. I'm actually, however, fairly sure that the rest of the world doesn't believe that. In fact, I'm confident that many of those who receive our nation's generosity don't even know it comes from us. And that needs to change. We are benevolent, but we're not benefiting to the extent that we can or should. We need to tell the American story better. Some American health initiatives are well known, like the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief or PEPFAR. Similarly, the President's Malaria Initiative or PMI is the foundational piece of a very important campaign among various countries and parts of civil society to defeat malaria. Congress recently authorized a remarkable $48 billion over the next 5 years for PEPFAR and PMI. History will conclude that in the area of global health, that President Bush has been noble, he's been bold, and he's been successful. But the next president, in my judgment, has a historic opportunity to take health diplomacy to even the next level. How? I believe that the next president should gather together PEPFAR and PMI and all of the activities of USAID, the Department of Defense, HHS, agriculture, and the EPA. We should then reach out to hundreds of American NGOs and faith-based organizations and universities and corporations and foundations and individuals, all of whom are doing charitable health work outside the borders of the United States today. And President Obama should then tie all of that together in a colorful banner and put that says to the world that we are collectively a generous and compassionate people. The president should issue a call to express our national compassion, not as a collection of soloists, but as a choir. He should ask them to brand their efforts with a common message, and the message is from the American people. Now, that's a phrase that's currently being used by USAID. Now, I'm not suggesting that any of the other organizations I've spoken of give up or abandon their individual identity, but I am suggesting that there would be an enormous benefit to them and to our country if we jointly built a reputation around those words. The most significant deficiency in the U.S. government foreign assistance delivery is the rather abysmal job that we do in branding ourselves and our activities. This is not only true of health alone, it's true across the board. Every agency of the federal government has its own focus and jealously guards its own turf. Often there are contests that have to be resolved by putting all of the participating agencies or having their seals and their symbols on the same material. Now, many of you who work in the international arena have seen this. Routinely, one can see printed material with up to 6 different logos from 6 different departments or agencies of the federal government. Now, this isn't merely a complaint about bad aesthetics or design. Rather, it's an observation that we're compromising our ability as a nation to highlight the generosity of the American people. We're undermining our own efforts. Now, for very good reasons, a lot of federal aid is delivered through non-governmental organizations all over the world. Most NGOs do an excellent job, and they are a real asset. Often the United States is overwhelmingly, however, the largest partner, or in some cases the exclusive funding partner of an NGO, but no one would ever know it. Services are almost always provided under the banner of the NGO. Nearly all of the ambassadors from the United States to other countries have stories of going to meetings where there is lavish praise provided to the goodness of an NGO, without a word being said about the fact that it's the United States of America who pays for it. It's from the American people. When patients are handed out their antiretroviral medication, in my judgment, it ought to come in a bag bearing the words, from the American people. When community health workers that we train and then pay for to go house to house in countries all over the world, they ought to be carrying a bag that displays the phrase, from the American people. But the sacks and the bags carry more than medicines. They carry a message from the people of the United States. Can you picture President Obama at a clinic in Pakistan as a mother is getting prenatal services? Can you see the message from the American people? Can you envision what it does to our country's brand if President Obama, during a stop in El Salvador, helps an American nonprofit immunize a child against polio under the banner of From the American People? This is not a trivial matter. The way our government does not optimize the benefit of our benevolence is something we need to change. Fixing the federal government's siloed approach, however, can only be done by the president. Fixing it one department at a time won't work. The next president, early on, should implement a common branding strategy across the government by executive order. Now, let me acknowledge that there are situations where it's imprudent for us to have the marks of the United States represented on our aid. There may be times when it undermines a host government, or it may, in fact, even put aid givers at some risk. And those situations can and should be accommodated, but it ought not to be our general rule. What can't be tolerated is the dilution of our foreign policy goals and the brand recognition that they carry out. Now, the multiplicity of different logos and goal and agency seals now is a product of a major change that occurred a couple of years ago. And it highlights another way we can tune up our soft power engine, and that's better coordination. More domestic-focused agencies and departments have become involved in providing foreign assistance to governments. Why? It's because that's where the health talent is. The Department of Defense, Health and Human Services, the EPA, the Department of Agriculture employ some of the best health talent in the world. When authorizing PEPFAR and PMI, Congress saw the virtue of involving non-traditional aid agencies. Included in that legislation was a new novel model of a coordinator. Mark Dybul, the AIDS coordinator, is here. We're proud to say he is a part of the Commission Corps and at HHS. He is the coordinator. The Global AIDS Coordinator was given responsibility for organizing and directing multiple agencies and governments that were already working globally on AIDS. The Global AIDS Coordinator has unusual powers in being able to determine the funding priorities and can help resolve interagency disputes. The system creates accountability, and it makes the coordinator responsible, reporting directly to the president. And I can attest the president knows the Global AIDS Coordinator and the Malaria Coordinator and looks to them and holds them responsible. People often talk these days about the development of the creation of a Department of Development. I'd like to suggest I think that's a bad idea. From my experience as a cabinet member in two different roles, I've learned that programs do better when they're supported cabinet-wide, not merely by one cabinet officer. The Department of Development would further compartmentalize them. Another way to improve our efforts, I might go on, is to say we need to leverage the symbols that we use. Previously, I mentioned the naval hospital ships and the powerful symbol that they produce when they pull into a harbor in any country in the world. You might be interested to know that the Chinese now have seen the power of this, and they're building smaller hospital ships that can enter into ports that our bigger ships can't get into. Now, some people worry that the periodic visit of a ship or other kind of large symbols is expensive and unsustainable. But the ship provides help. They think that the ship provides help and then just leaves. But what a ship brings is a powerful symbol, the same one that the Chinook helicopters did in Pakistan. It's the combination of the powerful symbol and then sustained on-the-ground efforts that brings about what Secretary Gates talked about, which is the integration of our soft and our hard power. So in summary, here's my advice to the next president. Use health diplomacy to advance your foreign policy objectives. Broaden the definition of what health diplomacy is. Include in the definition everything we do that improves water or health, or health security, or veterinary care, or environmental health. Second, unify the American brand. Adopt the USA banner from the American people across the entire government. Ask American NGOs, ask universities, faith organizations, corporations, and individuals to join in a chorus of goodness, not just a legion of soloists. And then highlight their activities from your pulpit. Coordinate health diplomacy across the government rather than compartmentalizing it. And finally, combine the powerful symbols that sustain that we have with sustained effort on the ground. May I close by just saying, in the 21st century, our nation is required to change, and we have to adapt. We face different enemies with new tactics. Our foreign policy is no exception. There are three ways in which our country can adapt to change. We can fight it and fail, or we can accept it and survive, or we can lead it and prosper. We are the United States of America. Let us lead. I'm told if I've said enough to inspire enough controversy to inspire one question, we can go ahead and have some conversation. So who would like to begin? Samuel?
Samuel Adenigens from Asia Chase. You mentioned your idea about whether it's necessary to have a Department of Development. The other concept I wanted you to address is whether it pays to have somebody who's in charge of diplomacy, like they had under Secretary for Diplomacy. What I gather from your statement is that the activity itself will speak for itself. So I don't know whether the concept of having somebody in charge of diplomacy, having an office of diplomacy would.
Thank you. I think President Bush has very ably highlighted the compassionate side of the United States with AIDS and PEPFAR. I think we can go further than that now that we've established that as a foundation. And my recommendation to the next president is that he seize on what we have done so far and build on it, and that he become the primary health diplomat of our country, and that he use this powerful, powerful instrument that speaks to the heart, and that we have the kind of strategic benevolence that it can produce. Now, in terms of the Department of Development, as I suggested, I think the expertise lies various places in the federal government. And it would be to try to take environmental capacity and put it into a department, to try to take AIDS and public health and disease protection, and to do all of those things and try to put it in one department would not only dissipate what's going on in the primary departments, but it would not allow for cabinet-wide support of this kind of an effort. And I think rather than compartmentalize it, we ought to coordinate it. And I like the idea of the coordinator. I think we've seen that work, and it's a model worth pursuing. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'd like you to talk a bit about the economic downturn and the consequences. And we know that we're entering a very difficult period. We know that in the poorest parts of the world that we can expect aggravated malnutrition and poverty and global inequities worsening in terms of health access. We also know that we're engaged in putting together fairly massive stimulus and recovery packages and that we're at a certain risk and reputationally of if we're not very careful in how we respond to the consequences in terms of health in the poorest parts of the country where we've made these large investments. Can you talk about the future and the strategy for this?
Yes, I can. I mentioned that I believe we need to have strategic benevolence. I also think we need to be strategic about the way we deploy our benevolence, not just where, but how. I think this argues that we're going to have to become very focused on prevention, and we've got to make certain that we're leaving behind the capacity for those we serve to take up on their own. We've got to partner with other countries as well. There will be an inevitable tension between our capacity to spend outside the United States and the need we have inside the United States, particularly as we begin to look at health care reform and the toll that health care spending within the United States has begun to take. And I see a day in the future when the spending we're doing on certain international programs will collide with our capacity to develop health care here. And that day inevitably will come, and we have to be preparing for it today by strategically choosing where we go and strategically determining what we do. And I think prevention is going to be the underlying key to that.
The Bush administration, I think, can be characterized very much by looking internationally, and with former Senator Daschle being named just this week as the next secretary, I hear that you are giving lots of advice to President-elect Obama, but I'm wondering whether Daschle hands might be tied by looking more domestically, and what your advice would be directly to him.
One of the things that about the Health Department of Health and Human Services that few people fully appreciate is the breadth of the areas in which it has some responsibility. Not only do we administer the Medicare and Medicaid and other health care programs, but we also have substantial responsibility, new responsibility, in areas like emergency response. 4 years ago, when I became secretary, our mission in emergency response was only beginning. We now carry a very large portion of the Homeland Security and emergency response portfolio in the country. We had responsibility through the FDA for food safety. Food safety and product safety has become a highly important issue, and it will require attention from the next secretary, as it has for me. The area I've spoken of today in protecting people inside the United States by activities outside the United States, all of those will be part of the responsibility of the secretary. Now, we are entering into a period where I hope we're going to have a serious and robust debate on domestic health care issues, and I expect that the next secretary will, in fact, be focused intensely on that issue, as well he should be. But all of these other areas will also be part of that responsibility, and he is an able manager, and I'm sure we'll be able to touch on each of them according to the priorities that they establish. We'll go to you, and then I'll come over to this side again.
Secretary, I have a question. A lot of what you said made me think. I'm a new health foreign service officer at USAID, and so what you said about health diplomacy as well as coordination and collaboration in the field just made me think that we've been focusing a lot, in our training and in events such as this that we go to, on foreign aid restructuring at a much higher level. But I guess hearing you speak today made me think that there's a missed opportunity right now, because there isn't anything really in our training time in Washington where we do find out sort of even what different agencies within HHS are doing. And thinking of it in a public health mindset, I've heard, horror stories about collaboration in the field, but why not do something preventative now? And I guess I'm saying it now because we're part of an initiative to double the size of the Foreign Service at USAID. So all of us are in training in Washington for a certain period of time, and perhaps those linkages could be made now. But I would love to hear any advice that you have on establishing that type of coordination at a much lower level.
Frankly, I could not answer your question in a more powerful way than you've asked it. I think the fact that you recognize that there is a deficiency in not knowing what happens at HHS or the Department of Agriculture or the Environmental Protection Agency or the Department of Defense. When you are deployed into any country in the world, you're going to find out that all of those agencies are doing things, and some of them are the same thing you've been trained to do. And that is the opportunity, but it's also the area where we need improvement. We have to begin to sing like a choir, not like a legion of of soloists. And I pointed out earlier, I think those of you who've worked around the world will attest, I am not exaggerating when I say there are many examples where we'll have 5 and 6 logos on the same material. Yes, we collaborated on the task, but we couldn't go without having our own silo represented, and it represents the tension that's there. And I believe that that can only be resolved by the President of the United States, by executive order, bringing this branding together where we can say, we represent the American people. This is about the generosity, the kindness, and the charitableness of the American people. And it will form a synergistic, powerful message to the world.
I'm wondering, yesterday when Obama confirmed that Daschle is going to be the next HHS secretary, he also said that he was going to create this office of reform in HHS. Do you think that that's necessary? It's kind of looking past just the current topic we're talking about, but do you think that's necessary for reform to create this other office?
I don't know a lot about what their plans are, and I'm not really in a position to comment on it. I know that they intend to make health care reform an important issue. I applaud that. We need an active, rigorous, forceful debate in our country about how to resolve the issues. Our current healthcare sector is just saturated with inefficiency. We can't sustain it. We have to do something. The debate cannot simply be about how we get everyone insured. It has to be about how we find ways to provide value in the system, not just volume in the system. There are a lot of ways to do that. We now need to have that debate, and we need to begin actively focusing on how to solve it. It's a different subject, one on which I'm tempted to break into song on, but I'll leave it at that. Yes, sir.
Several macroeconomists claim that about the subsidies in the U.S. to the agricultural sector, around in the order of $300 billion, somewhat offsets the amount of indirect effects that it has on the economies in many developing countries, that they can't get their products at the appropriate prices. I don't know if that number is very accurate. However, it does speak to some of the issues of the externalities that we're talking about in terms of development, and whether or not you think across the U.S. government, with the various different political interests in the agricultural sector, that those issues can ever be reconciled with our interest in economic development overseas.
I don't know the answer to that. That seems like it would require a team of Nobel Prize-winning economists to sort through the cross subsidies and different impacts. I'm probably not able to add a lot to your very thoughtful question. I do know that the things we do externally, we can get a lot more benefit from, and that's what I'm here to argue today. I'll go to you next.
There's no doubt the U.S. has done some fabulous work in the last eight years over international health efforts. That said, you quite often hear criticism from abroad of, there's an issue of duplication, whether it's the International Flu Pandemic Initiative, CDC bases or NAMRU abroad, PEPFAR and so on, can create duplication, can actually create an image of unilateralism for the U.S. So do you think there's actually also a need for greater multilateral cooperation, and maybe that provides a bit of attention also with your argument about branding?
Let me just acknowledge this. I believe the world is beginning to intuitively organize itself into networks, and that's at every level. And I believe that includes among nations doing charitable diplomatic work in the throughout the world. There is little doubt that if we unilaterally begin taking on these very difficult issues, we will be less successful than if we're doing it multilaterally. And in some ways, it is at tension. But there are many opportunities where it's not at tension, and in those where it is not, we ought to be focusing on branding ourselves well. Many of our partners do a better job of it than we do. And some that we're not necessarily partners, and you can go around the world and see this is a bridge built by this country, and everyone in that community knows who built the bridge. Or this is a piece of equipment that was provided by this country, and it's got a label on it, and everyone knows where it came from. My argument is that we're doing a lot more than we're getting credit for, and we need to do a better job of demonstrating our benevolence, because it leads to our benefit. And I would also argue that the more we are able to benefit from our benevolence, the more sustainable it will be. And in that debate between domestic and international resources, if we can demonstrate that people are understanding what we're doing, it will have a positive impact on the ability of appropriators to continue to justify this.
You've put forward a very compelling argument for health diplomacy and using that to promote global health. But I was wondering, you know, in this sort of time of very difficult economic times and sort of this isolationist protectionism and these kinds of attitudes, if there isn't, if there's another message to, other than just health diplomacy, that you might have either for the next administration or the government agencies or anyone, another argument for promoting global health. Why should, it's a difficult message for those of us in this field to kind of push this message or this idea.
I want to be clear. I believe what we're promoting isn't just global health. I think it is our diplomatic objectives. That's the first thing, is that it is a tool that will create a much more efficient and, I believe, lead to better outcomes in our overall foreign policy objectives. Second, it is very important to the health of people inside the United States that we're out there doing things that prevent illness and injury inside the United States. And I cited product safety. I talked about influenza and communicable disease. And third, I talked about the fact that it also has a great impact on everything else we do. If people have an understanding of a unique understanding that health provides, they are much more willing collaborators with us. I've spent a lot of time in the last year in China. The Made in China brand is very much under assault for reasons we all understand. The Chinese know that. They understand that. The Chinese people know that and are worried about it, not just because of their economic well-being, but because of what it means for products inside their country. Our work with them has been appreciated, not just because it helped them economically, but because it helped improve their systems inside their country. All of those are benefits. So this isn't just about global health. In my mind, it's about finding ways that we can benefit from our benevolence in not just our own health, but our economic well-being, as well as our strategic foreign policy interests, as well as our military interests. That's the way I think we ought to be looking at this. And there'll be a lot more sympathy in Congress for funding global health if they can see all of those benefits, and there'll be more sympathy among the American people. If you ask, I can't cite specifically this survey, but I've been told that if you ask the American people what percentage of the national budget goes to international to foreign aid, they'll tell you it's about this much, when in reality it's about this much. And therefore, there's always a pressure to say we need to diminish it. Well, we need to tell the story that it's not just about helping other people who are sick. There are people inside the United States that are sick that we haven't adequately helped. This is about expanding our foreign policy effectiveness. It's about creating a better integration between our military and the objectives we have there. It's about protecting our own health, and it's about our own economic well-being. That begins to bring this together in a story that I think is important to tell, and we all ought to be telling it. Yes, sir.
I was very interested by your story about both Cuba allowing or encouraging multiple physicians to be around the world, and Venezuela thinking about that. And thinking about how we can duplicate some of that in the U.S. I know the president-elect has talked about incentivizing young students and asking for volunteerism for college students to help pay for tuition. What are your thoughts about a recommendation around medical students' residency programs establishing permanent roles in third world countries as a way to help pay for and incentivize those students to contribute around the world and increase our brand and sort of our American awareness?
Well, there is a little tension on this one, too, because we have only about 25% of the primary care physicians we need inside the United States. And one of the dilemmas we face all over the world is that when we bring physicians in training here, they don't want to go back. And there is a tension among other health ministries, for example, about our help. We have chosen, I think wisely, to begin going into regions and trying to help them develop the capacity to train there. For example, in Panama, we organized a health training center with five Central American countries and the United States jointly training people in short-term skills, things like birth attendants, lab technicians, medical equipment repair, things they can't get. And one of the things we committed to them is that we'll help you do this, and we're not interested in being able to train them and then bring them to the United States. So there is a slight tension that exists within the United States on those same disciplines. I'll just say in closing, I think this points out two things. One is that there's a great opportunity for us in health, in the training of medical workers in other countries, because they leave not only with training skills, they leave with a very positive impression of the people who gave it to them. And the second thing I would say is that, on a much different topic, we need to change the model that we use to train health workers in the United States and outside the United States. You could double, triple the number of nursing schools and still not meet the demand we have. We've got to think of different ways of doing it, and we could do it the same way outside the United States. Listen, the time is up. You had a chance to... Oh, okay, one more, and then I'll finish it.
Secretary, I'm curious. The Bush administration has done so much to expand global health initiatives, and that would seem to be really the big challenge. So I'm surprised to hear you say that branding was so tough, coming up with a single unified brand in all of these activities. And I just wonder what the obstacles are to achieving that.
Well, first of all, I want to emphasize, I think that the president has been bold. He's been noble, and I believe he's been successful in establishing health as a primary tool of diplomacy, and that he has endeared our country to the world in doing so in a very special way. One cannot go to Africa without having that become very evident. However, there is a siloed mentality among departments of the federal government on many things, this being one of them. And one of the problems is that the budget is written in a way as to make it almost impossible to collaboratively work with other departments in an efficient way. One of the reasons, I suspect, that you see six logos on the same brochure is because in order to satisfy the budget requirements written into the law, they have to be represented on that brochure as to make clear they spent the money in a proper way. Well, it defeats our capacity to deliver the message we need to the right people. I believe in order to do that, it will need to be done through executive order with the president and the White House taking ownership of this, because there are just too many fractured interests around a large government for this to occur without that kind of leadership. I think it's a next logical step. It couldn't have happened until what President Bush has done, but there's now an opportunity for President-elect Obama to pick up all of those parts. And then, again, I want to emphasize, and then add to it the other remarkable, noble, charitable, and heartfelt things that are done by universities, by NGOs, by individuals, by faith-based organizations. You see them all over the world. And we need to put a ribbon around them and say, this is the United States, and this is from the American people, and the president could invite them to join in that choir. And it would be a powerful, persuasive, and long-lasting voice to the world. Thank you.